Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. Copyright 2005 by Hannah Holmes and published by Bloomsbury Publishing, New York, New York. In the last episode, the author was extensively studying the lives of the bugs in her yard. We resume Suburban Safari on page 44 with episode 5. But back to my survey. The creepy crawly habitat comes closer still to my own domicile. A spider has decided her ideal microhabitat is my office window, across which she has stretched a web. Eek! All those grabby legs, that hunching abdomen! I bear no ill will toward spiders, but they do give me an urge to screech. Two panes of glass separate us, and that helps. I glance at her. She's head down in the center of her web. Her eight legs radiate around her. She sways with the cool wind. I raise a hand to my side of the window. She's not delighted to make my acquaintance. Like a washing machine starting its spin cycle, she bounces in the center of her web until she's whirling in a circle. If I were a bird, would I now think her too large to eat or too ferocious? Unlike me, she conquers her phobia in a single encounter. The next day I open my hand at the glass again, and she's unmoved. I breathe deep and examine her in detail. Her abdomen, the size of a pea, appears soft with brown fur. A trail of white dots runs down the middle of her back, with a line of chocolate dots on each side. Her legs are checkered brown, black, and white. When she turns her underside to me, her usual position, I can see the thinnest silver rope connecting her spinnerets to the center of her web. She is an elegant creature. To soothe my psyche, I give her a round and pleasing name, Babette. The web itself is in the classic orb weaver style. I count 29 spokes, and each spoke is crossed by 26 rungs. The silk itself looks a bit fuzzy. Nose to the glass, I discover that the rungs are all strung with minuscule pearls, nearly beyond the limit of sight. I remember reading about this. One of the 6 or 8 silks that the orb weavers can produce forms sticky beads. When it comes out of the spider, it's coated with salts that attract moisture from the air. As water gathers on the silk, gluey beads form. The wet beads trap insects and also keep the web taut, yet stretchy. The spokes themselves are made from a different silk and aren't sticky. When a fly collides with the web, Babette grips 2 spokes of her web, clamping them in tiny claws. She tugs as if testing a fishing line. She likes what she feels. She trundles down the spokes and grabs the fly. With her rear legs, she pulls silk from the nozzles under her abdomen and whips it around the fly. Then she sinks in her fangs to inject a pulse of poison. Carrying the wrapped meat in her mouth, she returns to the center of the web. She alternately spits chemicals into the fly and sucks out fly soup. In the web, gaping holes mark her path. Each time her foot fell on a gluey rung, she destroyed it. And the next morning, the web is gone completely. I'm a tiny bit disappointed. A day later, though, the web is back. This establishes a pattern. Whenever Babette has caught a few meals and trashed her web, she cleans it out. She leaves the thick ropes that frame the orb and moor it to my house. Then she applies new spokes and lays on the sticky rungs. I catch her at this only once and watch her pull 2 strands of silk from her spinnerets with both back legs. The 2 strands merge, and when she's produced enough, she dabs her abdomen against a spoke, fastening a rung. Over an hour, she repeats this 750 times. The freshest rungs are smooth and silvery, but by the time she's halfway to the center, the first laid rungs are purling with glue. I never catch her clearing out an old web. She does it in the wee hours of the night, evidently, or when she knows I'm out of town. Many spiders eat the silk when they remake their webs, recycling their extraordinary proteins. Babette is too cagey to reveal her secrets. She's not shy about eating insects, though. She eats a lot of them. One day she scores a large robber fly. This inch-long fellow won my admiration after I read about the trials he endures when mating. The females are such knee-jerk assassins that a courting male either holds out food or waits until the lady already has a mouthful of something else. I suppose it's a spider-eat-fly-eat-gnat world, but I was sorry to see Babette straitjacket the big boy, suck him empty, and cast his remains onto the heap of exoskeletons that must be accruing on the cellar door below. Far more disturbing was the housefly, who spewed maggots. As Babette tucked into this meal, I noticed something white wriggling out of the fly's abdomen. Huh? Out came a maggot, waving its tiny head as though it had never dreamed of hatching 25 feet in the air on a sticky trampoline. It was followed by another and another. By the time this horror movie was over, the fly had disgorged 7 larvae, probably the progeny of a parasitic wasp or fly. All plummeted to the carcass pile, leaving Babette's feast diminished. My spider's behavior will become erratic toward the end of the summer. She'll sleep late on cold mornings, emerging from the eaves at noon. Sometimes she'll leave her web unmended for a day or two, perhaps to molt. Her sisters, whom I'll discover nearby, will do much the same. Below Babette in the garden, one sister will spend days on end, disguised as part of a dead plant stalk, minimizing her odds of being spotted by a bird. And on the front porch, a third sister will retreat to the ceiling, scuttling down to her web only when she senses a good juicy reason. Each will swell to the size of a peanut. Babette's a she-spider, saving up calories to convert to eggs. Male spiders are usually small, and they quit the web-making business as soon as they make a final molt into maturity. They turn their energies to mating. A male will load his sperm into his palps, antenna-like wings under his chin, then approach a likely web. To avoid being mistaken for a blue plate special, he'll pluck the web with a species-specific rhythm. He might build a special mating thread onto the web and invite the lady onto it. Then she might invite him onto her web, where, after long spidery conversations, he might be permitted to empty his palps into a pouch on her underside. A few weeks after Babette mates, she'll produce about 1,000 eggs and wrap them in the appropriate type of silk. And then, unless she's one of the few overwintering species, she'll die. In September, Babette will disappear from my window. My only souvenir will be a remnant of web that a storm plasters to the glass. For a while, the outline of the strands will remain, with a film of glue oozing down the pane. Then more storms will pelt the window with snow, and the last of Babette's web will vanish. Maybe next year her spiderlings will emerge from the eaves to continue my desensitization. My tour of habitats confirms that if there is one truly global citizen of the insect world, it is the ant. I find ants high in the trees, deep in the ground, all through the grass, and under every rock I turn over. They farm aphids on the tomato plants, gathering honeydew excretions in payment for bodyguard services. They collect a nectar fee from tiny nectaries on the peony buds, again in exchange for fighting off harmful insects. They carry daisy seeds across the walkway and into the ground. Ants are ubiquitous. I had asked Dick Dearborn if the ants in my yard collectively outweigh me. Probably. One day I find a train of ants climbing the pole to the hummingbird feeder. I pull up a chair to watch. A few are large and black, but most are a zippy golden variety. Trafficking up and down the pole, they stop and tap antennae with every other ant they meet. Those who are ascending make their way onto the top of the feeder, then crawl down the plastic globe, their feet searching for a grip. They negotiate the overhang where the bottle narrows into a red disc. And there, where a film of sugar water glimmers between bottle and disc, they wedge themselves to drink. The base of each yellow flower is also ringed with drinking ants, and a stream of ants, abdomens glowing pink with sugar water, returns up the bottle and down the pole. Back in Zippy Town, they'll cough up the goods, just as bumblebees and honeybees do, for their kin to consume. That they're feeding here, 4 feet off the ground, means that some enterprising scout trundled all the way up here by herself, just checking, just making sure no food was hanging around uncollected. When she found it, she laid a chemical trail back to Zippy Town, and the work cast hopped on the trail. When I sit at the base of the pole to locate Zippy Town, I'm distracted by the plight of a gnat. It landed on the pole and somehow became stuck there. It can't, or won't, fly away. Every ant that ascends the pole frisks this gnat before continuing. Finally, an ant walks over the gnat's back, patting and prodding, and grabs a leg. When the ant tugs, the gnat slides. Encouraged, the ant hugs the gnat's abdomen and hoists it clear of the pole. The gnat's wings unfurled in the ant's face makes an uncooperative load, but slowly the ant turns to descend the pole. Puffs of wind toss the gnat's wings. The ant's feet shiver over the metal, wanting traction. One after another, those feet release. Ant and gnat blow off the pole and into the garden. From what I've seen of ant work, it could take the ant the rest of the afternoon to get this meal home. What species these are, I couldn't say. North America is home to about 600 kinds of ant. Most eat of a varied diet, taking gnats and sugar water where they find it. Other species consume only the eggs of spiders and other arthropods, or only seeds, or only other ants. A few farming species consume only fungus that grows on the leaves they shred, or the honeydew excreted by aphids they tend like herds of cattle. Few are helpful pollinators, more are nectar stealers. Most are nature's little tillers, aerating and mixing the soil. The black ants on the pole are mellower than the Zippy Town ants. Perhaps their diet runs more to seeds than sugars. To test the theory, I load a chopstick with crystallized honey and dab blobs on a rock at the base of the pole. In a few minutes, two Zippy Towners and two Mellow Burgers find the blobs. But after 15 minutes, Zippy Town's honey is a scene of frenzy, while just 4 Mellow Burgers mill around their blob. And after 30 minutes, Mellow Burg has rolled up the sidewalks, and all the ants have gone home. Except one. She's claimed the chopstick itself. I carry her to the microscope. Magnified, she's not black, but mahogany. Her large eye is grainy with individual lenses. Her face ends in something of a beak. This is pushed into a cavity she has mined in the honey. Beneath the beak, all hell is breaking loose. In contrast to a human mouth, the ant's mouth is crammed with tools. Half a dozen palps and jaw parts seem to be involved, some flailing at the honey, others shoveling it in. Liquefied honey floods her open mouth. Every few seconds, she pauses to swallow. As if telegraphing her bliss, one antenna and one foot drum on the chopstick. I set her back on the rocks of Mellow Burg. On another day, 3 winged ants struggle up the lawn chair I'm sitting in and take to the sky. It's mating day. Most species of ants send forth their winged reproductives on the same day. In some species, the males of many different anthills will swarm in one place, above a tree or over a roof, for for instance. They'll slap on some pheromone aftershave and the girls will come flying. In other species, the girls exit the nest, fly to a homey spot, and then do the perfuming. Either way, the result tends to be a lot of winged ants in the air at a time. The vast majority will be eaten by birds, reptiles, or even ants and other insects. Or they'll drown, or fail to find a mate. Or I'll set a chair on them. But that's why there are so many. One is bound to get lucky. A mated queen will shed her wings, dig her burrow, and start a family. Lately, when I step onto the lawn, I think about how many little beetles are holding their breath, pressed between my foot and the baked soil. How many spiders flatten in the grass, waiting for me to move on? How many sow bugs? How many ants drop their burden, then spent an hour hunting for it? Although I do worry about squashing them, I'm happy to learn that so many insects are at home in my backyard ecosystem. Insects are versatile, Dick Dearborn tells me. I don't think they notice the difference between urban and rural settings. They've got a lot of different things to feed on, a lot of places to hide. Almost every species of mosquito in the state is here. And I'd say the number of ground beetle species is about the same as anywhere else, too. At least that's the case in my yard, where no pesticides soak the greenery. On some lawns this summer, the usual toxic chemicals will be augmented by mosquito poisons, as some cities try to fight West Nile by fogging every living thing. The spraying campaigns are reigniting a decades-old fight between those who yearn to destroy one pest and those who want to protect thousands of innocent species. Dick expresses no ambivalence. Pesticides disrupt everything, he growls. They're disastrous. In Maine, West Nile flutters on, unhampered by mosquito poison. In a 10-mile circle around my yard, mosquitoes infect crow after crow, and the birds, hemorrhaging, tumble to the ground. The red dots on my dead crow map cluster close to my neighborhood. Perhaps mosquitoes in the deep woods are infecting as many birds, but no one is picking them up. Perhaps in this instance, suburbanites are on the front lines of observing a plague as it sweeps through the natural world. Chapter 3. Lawn of Many Waters. This year, April showers didn't promise May flowers. The ground didn't thaw until the end of March, so the melting snow ran down the street instead of soaking the soil. Then, when the ground was soft, the rain quit. Last year was droughty, too. Out in the country, wells are going dry as if water were going out of style. Here in town, the drought strikes only one of the three water sources in my yard, the water that falls from the sky. A separate river system, stolen from the lake north of here, flows through the neighborhood inside iron pipes. And a third source lies untapped 96 feet under my turf. At least, that's what the dowser will tell me. The drought shouldn't be a disaster for my yard. Trees and shrubs can constrict the mouth-like stomates in their leaves to hold in moisture. They can put less water into their fruits, delaying reproduction for a year. They can grow less. My animals should be fine, too. And they could teach me a thing or two about water management strategies. As an animal, Homo sapiens relies heavily on water. I exhale a pint of it, doing nothing more strenuous than sleeping at night. It exits my skin constantly. I pee extravagantly. To counteract my leakiness, I need about 10 cups of liquid a day. I drink 60% of it and extract another 30% from my food. Metabolism in my cells cobbles together H's and O's to make the last 10%. Other animals, especially small ones, and particularly desert dwellers, are more resourceful. The kangaroo rat can wring all his water from food and metabolism, and he retains that water by concentrating his urine 5 times more than my body can. Even in temperate zones, some critters get much of their water from food and recycle that water carefully. The deer mice in my yard safeguard their moisture by working in the cool of night. They waste little water on their dry feces, and their pee is 4 times more concentrated than mine. My crows, instead of flushing urea waste from their body with a flood of water, concentrate it in their kidneys and eject a paste of white crystals along with their dark feces. Even squirrel pee is more concentrated than mine. I know my animals evolved to survive drought, but I can't help helping them. After noticing the crows sitting in the shade with their bills gaping in the heat, I do something I've never bothered with before. I buy a bird bath. For the squirrels, mice, and ground birds, I also fill an old broiler pan and place it in the shade of the chokecherry tree. And when a young chipmunk becomes a regular visitor in my kitchen, I set a dish of water on the floor for him, too. The chipmunk. I catch sight of him first in the cold, late spring. He's gathering maple twirlies from the driveway beside the house and scooting under the front porch to stash them. I haven't seen a chipmunk here before. Having recently hand-fed one at my grandmother's apartment, I've been pining for one, though. And here he is. He's small and his tail is slim, suggesting he's a young lad dispersing out of his mother's territory. His copper fur, striped with black and white, is pristine, unflawed. He's in perpetual motion, a busy, busy boy. I'd love to feed him, tame him, but I worry. It's not that I fear he'll become a pest. Chipmunks rarely invade walls, and I don't care if his tunnels disturb my haphazard flower beds. My concern is that I'll falsely influence his choice of territory. That I've never had a chipmunk before could mean that my yard doesn't meet their needs. There are definitely too many cats, and there may be other threats I'm unaware of. Maybe there's insufficient food or inadequate shelter. So I wait. If he chooses my yard on his own merits, then I'll mess with him. He stays. So after 2 weeks, I sit down on the deck with a handful of sunflower seeds. I toss the seeds loudly on the planks. Within 5 minutes, the chipmunk pops up the steps and vacuums the seeds around me, bumping my hand in the process. With his cheeks bloated, he dashes into the lilac hedge to unload. I scatter more seeds and keep a few in my palm. When he returns, he cleans the deck, then sniffs around my hand a few times. He stretches the triangle of his head over my hand. I feel a slight pressure as his teeth and tongue gather a seed. Then another and another. His front feet step onto my thumb. Then the back feet follow. He's perched in my palm, hoovering seeds. As he shifts them into his cheeks, the seeds make a dry grinding sound. Bulging, he bolts. The next time he comes, I keep all the seeds in my palm. Up he hops to collect them. Slowly I move my thumb toward his head and stroke his fur. He leaps away, but comes back. I spend an hour with the chipmunk, raising and lowering my hand slowly with him aboard. His fur is silky velvet, nearly too soft to feel. The next morning I surprise him in the kitchen. I habitually open the back door to let the day in, and he has availed himself of the invitation. "You're a cheeky bugger," I tell him as he skitters under the stove. I sit on the floor, seeds in hand, and wait. After a minute, his deer-colored nose comes into view. I drop a seed loudly on the floor. The black eyes appear. I drop another. The ears are out. After a few false starts, Cheeky walks cautiously across the floor. He picks up a seed. When he locates my handful, he forgets his fear and gets busy. Then, zing, he's over my legs and out the door and off the back of the edge of the deck. I go about my business, only to catch a coppery blur zipping behind the refrigerator 3 minutes later. Cheeky's back, and his cheeks are empty. Cheeky turns up the next morning, too, and the next, and the next. Day by day I make him climb onto my lap to get his seeds, then onto my shoulder. Shaking a cup of seeds, I lead him to the top of a wooden stool where I leave the cup. Now when he arrives, he doesn't have to risk being stepped on to get my attention. I'll hear the gritch-gritch of seeds, and there he'll be, perched on the cup's rim, his body rolled into a stripy ball as he dives in. Occasionally I'll confiscate the seeds and put him through his paces. During one session, I count out 150 seeds to offer for each visit, to see how many he can shove into his face. He averages 77, and he's still a teenager. I try to vary his diet, offering banana chips, almonds, peanuts, and figs. He's finicky. If no seeds are available, he'll eat a few bites of fig and then haul the fruit away for storage. He'll sometimes sample a banana chip. The only serious competition to sunflower seeds comes from oranges. He'll grip a slice with his tiny front claws and tear at the juicy flesh. He smacks his lips, shreds of pulp hanging from his chin. I soon habituate Cheeky to adoration. From thumb stroking, I move to patting him with a finger. At first he ducks away, although he doesn't stop gathering seeds. Then he gives in. I run a finger from his nose to his rump and let his bottle brush tail slide through my hand. I raise him to my face. As he works at the seeds in my palm, I lower my nose to his fur. I give his round back a smooch. That I'm kissing a chipmunk makes me laugh, and Cheeky gives a little bounce of alarm. But he works on, weaseling the last seeds from the creases of my hand. I bend again and sniff his fur. He smells of earth and yarrow, a spicy weed that grows in my lawn. I wonder if he lines his bedroom with it, as starlings do. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of The Maine Reader. We're reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. This is The Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.